Now, Australia's colossal comedy hit, starring its newest comedy hero, comes to the States. Just let me hear some of that Yahoo Sirius is Young Einstein.
Albert Einstein.
He is destined to create the most powerful scientific theories in history.
I discovered the formula for splitting beer atoms.
And welcome to another installment of Pod Stallions. We've been away for a while, but we're back. We're energetic. I am Brian, and to my left is Jason.
Hello, everyone.
And the subject this week is the time when, well, I don't know about you, Jason, but I was a lot thinner and had a lot more hair and a lot more energy, the summer of 1989, and we're going to talk about the movies, which is very topical because it is the 30th anniversary of the release of that summer's biggest movie, which is, of course, Yahoo Sirius in Young Einstein.
Yes, and I think it's been way overdue for us to do a Yahoo Sirius tribute episode.
Absolutely.
As well.
Most definitely.
So this will kill two birds with one stone. Basically.
So where were you in the summer of 89?
Well, it's funny you say that. This is going to sound completely cliche and sad at the same time. But when these anniversaries are sort of coming up, you know, 40th anniversary of Star Trek, the motion picture, 30th
barf.
Of Batman,
barf.
The Cars, Candy O, you know, stuff like that, like, you know, Breakfast in America. I am having these moments of going, oh, wait a minute. Not just an anniversary of a thing. It's an anniversary of a thing in my lifetime. And we're getting past the 5, 10, 15 year mark for these anniversaries. I am getting older, and
like,
I don't like that.
When the 66 Batman show turned 50, I was like, I don't care, you know.
Exactly.
That was
exactly.
Canceled the year before I was born, you know.
Exactly. This is a slightly different story, and it's kind of hitting me that way. I remember the summer of 89 being a massive summer, and being a huge Indiana Jones fan, of course, I was thrilled about another Indiana Jones movie. I think I'd first read about that in the newspaper in 88 when I'd read that Sean Connery was going to be playing his father, which, I mean, that's where I got my information, was the newspaper, basically.
Yes.
But it was a big summer. But where Batman is concerned, I've really been thinking about this a lot the last few weeks about just how massive that movie was, and just how it kind of over, as big as that summer was, how it kind of overshadowed everything around it, and also the stuff leading up to it. And while I have vague memories of information sort of slipping out, what I do remember distinctly, I know that when Michael Keaton was announced, there was this huge uproar. I do remember that. I remember the first time hearing his name. I mean, I knew who Tim Burton was because they'd mentioned Beetlejuice, and I knew Pee Wee's Big Adventure because I had it on video cassette. And I thought, ooh, this could be interesting. But when they did mention Keaton's name, and I've loved Keaton since Night Shift, I did have a moment of, oh, what is this thing going to be? Like most people, I think, did. You know, Clean and Sober hadn't come out yet, and yada, yada, yada. Anyway, I remember bits of that. But what I remember the most is that first trailer hitting.
Yeah.
And just posted
Deep
it the other day.
Six.
That trailer was such a mind F because it came out of nowhere. I hadn't heard about it. It was just in the theater. I don't remember what I saw that it played in front of.
Deep Star Six.
Number one. Okay. There was something else that it, because I know I saw it in the theater in front of something, and it blew my head off. I don't think I ever saw Deep Star.
Oh, okay.
Deep Six Nine.
Just to give you clarity, or my take on it, our local comic book store, which was behind the movie theater, had a big sign with a picture from Mr. Mom saying, you know, sign this petition to get rid of this guy. You know, we don't want Mr. Bat-Mom. But when that trailer hit, the owner of the store, Ken, who is still a friend, he organized like trips to the movie theater just to see the trailer. You know, like we were allowed to come in and watch it and then leave.
Yeah, people were calling theaters wanting to know when that trailer was going to run. But what I remember about it was the Warner Brothers logo, a bit of music, no voiceover. I'm not sure up to that point if I had seen a trailer that didn't have some kind of voiceover in it.
Right.
There are huge chunks of it that don't have any music at all. And then when it wraps up, it's just the logo. It's the Bat logo. No, I've never seen a trailer that didn't have the title of the film. The audacity, the brilliance of them saying, we got to get a trailer out here quick because, you know, nervousness is building. You know, the studio is worried. Da, da, da. We got to put something together, which is exactly what they did to get it out and get people to shut up. But the confidence in what they were doing to say, we're just going to put the logo up. And, of course, it blew everyone's mind.
Yeah, and it was every other movie was not Batman that summer.
Yes, I mean, this is the trailer. I'm saying just the trailer. And suddenly that's when the groundswell started to happen and people started to realize, oh, this is not what we thought it maybe was going to be. And there's a huge story we could talk about the making of it and the nightmares of putting it together and how horribly it could have gone and, you know, all those things. But when everything leading up to it and all the merchandise and the T-shirts and, you know, you couldn't find the toys and, you know, all this stuff. And then it happened and it was that moment of, oh, my God, they got it right. Like, I mean, people badmouth it and trash it and they hated it from day one. I loved it then. I love it now. I love Keaton. They pulled off the impossible at that time. But it was a big summer. And so what I remember about, you asked me like where I was when I was doing, you know, I was 18 or 19, whatever it was. And I used to get Premiere magazine. Do you remember Premiere magazine?
I do very much. Yeah.
It was my Bible. And, you know, in the middle of the magazine, it was a French magazine that they brought to America. And in the middle of the magazine, they used to have these perforated cards, like a sheet of four cards that were movie posters. And then on the back of each card was the description of the movie and who's in it and who directed it and, you know, da, 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 da. And I used to collect those things because I get this issue, this magazine every month. So even then I was, you know, at 17, 18, 19, I was curious about the industry and about movies and TV and who was doing what and so on. And I remember their summer issue, and I think it had Ford and Spielberg on the cover. And they listed their predictions. They always did a prediction of like the top 10 or top 15 movies of the summer of 89. And I think Batman was like, I could be getting this wrong. I think Batman was like number 3 or 4 or 5. Like Yahoo Serious, they put Young Einstein in like the top 8.
Oh, they, you know, really saying, thought like, that was going to be huge.
They thought that was going to be huge because he was such a thing in Australia.
Yeah.
And yeah, they thought it was going to be huge. And Star Trek V might have been like 4th or 5th. Because Star Trek IV had done so much business that they, of course, they put that in Indiana Jones. I don't know what number one was. But Batman, they didn't even have confidence enough in Batman to say, this is going to take the summer. I think it was going to be like number 3. I could be wrong.
They really thought Great Balls of Fire was going to be massive, too. Do you remember that?
Yeah, was that 89? That was the same summer. Dennis Quaid.
Yeah, they really thought that. And you know what was weird was, and you know how you're like, this is how young I was. I hated that movie because I thought it was going to like make Batman the number 2 movie that year. And I wanted Batman. Yeah, I know this. It sounds alien to say this.
I love it.
I was like, you know, love it. Screw you, Dennis Quaid. And then, of course, the movie just completely bombed.
It bombed.
But I really didn't want it to succeed.
Well, let's talk about this because I'm curious about this. Because here's the thing that I love about you it's fascinating about the things that you're into and that you love and stuff. You know, you love a lot of left of center and niche stuff. Oh, you like a lot of stuff that is and was very popular as well.
Oh, sure.
You know, like you don't you dig Star Wars from a certain period. You're not a Star Wars, you know, lover. But you like so I think sometimes people forget that, like, you're into a lot of, you know, plenty of mainstream stuff that you dig.
Oh, absolutely.
And, like,
yeah, I'm not a complete hipster. I love, you know,
lots of stuff.
You know?
But you've always been a little bit more of a DC guy, I think.
I like Spider-Man and Captain America, you know, and Fantastic Four. That's about it. And then I like.
So what was your mindset going into this thing before it came out? When you saw it, like, were you a big fan of the TV series, or did you kind of poo-poo it at that point? Or?
No, I thought it was fine. I was a big fan at the time, and this is a long time ago. I was actually, I had a comic book, like, I had long boxes of comic books. I was still into comics, and I was very much into toys. I was a huge Mego collector at that time, and I loved anything. Like, I used to have a library of, like, live-action Spider-Man episodes, Japanese Spider-Man episodes. I was collecting, like, Ultraman and Kamen Rider stuff at this time. I had bootlegs of the Legends of the Superheroes. You know, I loved live-action superhero stuff a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm still a fan of that genre. It's just now, like, we are in an abundance, you know, where I'm actually going, I'm not going to go see that in the theater. And, you know, there's a little part of me that goes, what? But, you know, it's just, I never envisioned this timeline, you know?
No, exactly. This was, I mean, that's why, you know, I got so high off of Endgame, you know, Infinity War and Endgame, because even though it's going to be on DVD in a few months, and even though the internet, there are so few things that are event movies these days. But like you say, there's plenty of stuff. Like, if I hadn't seen Captain Marvel at the theater, I'd see it soon enough, and, you know, I missed it, like, you know, the two Ant-Mans or whatever. But Batman, you know, this was when, you know, going to see a movie opening night, I mean, this is you know, I'm talking Minnesota, you know, St. Paul, Minnesota kind of thing. I felt like I was, you know, going to a Beverly Hills premiere if I went to, like, you know, a theater opening night. Like, here we are on the red carpet.
Oshawa Center is where I was, and I bought the Prince soundtrack that night on tape. And, yeah, it was a big deal.
Oh, wow. That's great.
And I ran into Ken, who ran Ken's Comics, and he says, I've already seen it at the premiere, you know. And he then spoiled it for me, which was odd, but okay. And then,
he,
you know,
spoiled it for you?
Yeah, he's like, you know, I didn't really like them having the Joker kill Bruce Wayne's parents. And I'm like, hey, you know.
You know, what's funny is people probably know this, but there's a famous clip of Keaton, who I will never stop just loving, Michael Keaton, one of the funniest humans alive. But he's been on Letterman 100 times, but he's on Letterman the night or two nights before the movie premieres. And he lets it slip, and Letterman kind of goes, and then he's like, yeah, but he's the guy. He's like, yeah, well, Batman doesn't know that he killed his parent, you know, the Joker, but he finds out. And then he stops himself, and he's like, oh, I think I might have just spoiled the movie for a lot of people. Like, he gives the ending away, two nights before.
Do you remember the Pat Sajak show?
The talk show?
Talk show.
I remember he had one.
He used to have a writer on that would come out dressed as Robin, because around that time, I think they had killed Robin off that year. And, you know, he would just have Robin on doing sketches. And it was like Robin had been dumped and he's trying to restart his career. It was actually, I remember watching some of those, and they were really funny. Like, you know, I saw Bat Dance. I have my own video, and they show this video, and it's called Batman Sucks. You know, he's just dancing around to the 66 Batman theme. Yeah.
I don't know if I remember that the Pat Sajak show was remotely that hip or with it.
You know, it really wasn't.
They were doing anything like that.
Pat Sajak couldn't ever seem to not smirk. But that was a little bit he was doing where he'd have Robin on, and it was clearly just one of their writers dressed as Robin. You know, he was a 40-year-old guy. But it was really funny, and it just showed you how much Batman was, like, that was in the public eye. You know, there was a lot of... It was everyone was talking about Batman, and that was such a weird time to be alive, because let's face it, like, you saw, even on my honeymoon, this is going back to the late 90s, I remember I went out to dinner with my wife at a restaurant, and I was wearing a Green Lantern t-shirt, you know, before Big Bang Theory ruined DC comic shirts for me.
Also romantic.
Yeah, very romantic. Yeah, oh yeah. And we're eating dinner, and the waiter comes up to me and goes, "I got to show you this." And he pulls up his sleeve, and he's got a Superman tattoo. And it's like, ooh. You know, we were in a little club, you know, him and I, at that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, like, mm-hmm. he was very proud mm-hmm. of comic books, and he saw a guy with a DC t-shirt and said, "That guy gets it." And that, right. we were kind of obscure. And that was like 10 years after Batman. So, like, in the late 80s, to see people wearing Batman t-shirts and hats and that sort of thing, it was exciting. It was, you know, it was really interesting.
It was. And he and Spider-Man were my two favorite characters as a kid. Mm-hmm. In the, whatever comics I would get. And I always got, like, Captain America and the Falcon comic. I used to love that.
Oh, God, yeah, me too, yeah.
Just love that. But it was kind of a big deal. And it was right around the turn, too, where I sort of, you know, like, The Living Daylights had come out in 87, and it kind of, you know, I'd always loved Bond throughout my life, but all of a sudden here I am, you know, a teenager now, and it's back to basics Bond. And I thought, oh my gosh, now I can really get into this, because this is not the campy stuff. This is really something. And I had just, by 89, I had just started to discover, you know, that Star Wars, the Power of the Force figures existed, the 84 line with the Carbonite Han and stuff like that. You know, different shops were starting to kind of pop up, and the collecting thing started to kind of happen too, because, oh, here comes another Indiana Jones movie. And I started to collect the Kenner stuff, and you could get a, you know, a loose Marion figure for, you know, $15 back then or something. And that was a lot of money to spend. So all of that was sort of happening at the same time. And all of a sudden, you know, Batman. And I remember a lot of people talk about this and say that it was a flyer that was handed out at the theater. I remember the catalog coming to me fully formed somehow.
Warner Brothers catalog.
I don't remember how. And I had somewhere. I still have that original catalog somewhere. That original first Warner Brothers catalog from 89 that had Keaton on, had all these characters, had Bugs Bunny and whoever else, and then Keaton on the cover. And you open those first couple of pages, and there was this Batman merchandise.
Yep.
You know, the Toy Biz Batcave and the figures and the Batmobile. Those Kent
Which
Melton
looked way better than the actual physical Toy Biz.
Well, and again, that's what's fascinating too, is you realize that they didn't know what was coming.
Yeah.
Like Toy Biz that just did not know stuff wasn't ready in time and not enough stores.
Well, I worked with a guy who actually helped set up that deal. This happened.
Oh, the Toy Biz Batman movie deal?
Yeah, he told me that actually he got the license from Warner Brothers. He got it through Warner Brothers Canada. And he had said, you know, nobody wants this license. And the company he was working for was called Charon. And somehow Charon and Toy Biz kind of formed. He tried to explain it to me. I haven't spoken to him in a long time. I should probably. But yeah, he said, yeah. And the reason I know he's not full of crap is that, A, the reason I know him is because Warner Brothers called me once and said, "We got this guy who wants to work on a promotion. Do you want to get involved?" And they told me, you know, yeah, he's been working with us for years. So I knew he, you know, he did have some clout in the industry. And he's the guy who said, yeah, I helped set that all up. And they, yeah.
So my question was always, because I know that Toy Biz had, I could be wrong about this, and someone I'm sure will correct me, but Toy Biz was doing DC figures. I want to say right before the Batman toys hit.
Nope.
They had did not.
Nope.
So the separate DC license they had, where they made a Two-Face.
All came around like the end of the summer.
Toy Biz, so Kenner had the DC thing for superpowers.
Yeah.
right?
And but they then didn't that want Batman, left. They didn't want the Batman movie, apparently, or, you know, whatever.
So there you go. So Kenner, Hasbro, Mattel, nobody wanted this thing.
Nobody
like
wanted
nobody,
it.
Nobody jumped on this thinking that it was gonna do anything. Like, yeah. I think that there, people forget. I mean, like you just said a minute ago about the dearth of stuff, and like, we, you know, there's so much out there, and what we'll get to, and so on. I always defend this movie whenever people, well, it should have been this or could have been this or I hate Burton. People forget what an uphill climb it was to do this thing and to make this movie, not just to make it, but to make it the way I firmly believe it only could have happened the way that it did with Tim Burton. Like, mm-hmm. It would not have happened. You would not have gotten the product you did if it was, you know, a Joel Schumacher or some other working man sort of director. They got someone that was proven, but they clearly went to bigger people that turned it down, or that, you know, they couldn't get it off the ground or whatever. And they thought, well, this guy, we can control him a bit, but he's also got a bit of a vision, or, you know, whatever stories people want to tell now that the thing is a hit, you know, a hit has many parents, but a failure is an orphan and all that stuff. But people forget just how risky this thing was. And so the toy biz deal, so how far ahead of the movie, do you know how far ahead of the movie hitting the deal was done?
No, I don't. I just know that it was seat of your pants stuff. That's why in that Warner catalog, they just have a repainted Batman from the Superpowers
right.
line. And then when the figure we got was not... I know people that love that line, and you know, it's their childhood, so I won't crap on it.
Oh.
But I was like, oh.
But it was a big deal to go, and I felt emboldened is the wrong word, but I didn't feel like I felt like I was not hiding something in a brown paper bag. Like, I was kind of, you know, I was in the middle of the zeitgeist here, like something big was happening, and so for me to go into a Target or wherever and buy a Batman figure, it was like, yeah, man, everybody's, you know, it wasn't like a niche thing. It was, this thing is going to be huge, or this is big, or whatever.
You know, the only time I felt like that was in college, when Superman died, all my roommates wanted a copy of the comic. So I like went to a store and like, here you go. You're not going to get rich, you know?
When the Hook toys hit, you got all those, didn't you?
Of course.
And you
went
out and get all...
They're right next to Captain Planet.
All the Hook variant?
Oh, yeah. The Rufios. All the Rufios.
No, but it was a big deal. But it did feel also like there was kind of a turn where suddenly, even, you know, at that young age, I could step back and look at the summer that was coming and go, This is huge. We've got Indiana Jones, we've got Ghostbusters 2, Batman, License to Kill, another Bond film, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which was a genre thing,
yep.
But I knew that it was Joe Johnston, you know, directed, and I knew the name from
The Rocketeer,
Star Wars, although it was work on Star Wars and stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'll see that. And was Back to the Future 2? Now, I'm not a Back to the Future.
No,
I love the original
film.
That wasn't
summer.
Was that in the fall or something?
Yeah,
was that later in the fall?
Yeah.
So it wasn't that summer. So
yeah, I always, it's weird to equate that. I equate Batman because I was, you know, senior in high school, you know, going, had a lot of friends, had a really great steady relationship, had a great, you know, who gives a shit job at a pizza place. And by the end, so that summer is just this exciting, wonderful thing. And then by the end of that summer, the pizza place went out of business. I think Back to the Future 2, I remember I got a big fight with my girlfriend. So I hate that movie. It's just like all this stuff went to crap, you know?
Well, I remember, and I think it went like this. I think it went Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Star Trek V, Ghostbusters 2, and then Batman, I think,
yes.
Maybe?
Yes, you're right.
Okay, so it was like every couple of weeks, and that was huge.
Yeah, you,
so
were, like, you, event, were, you were just you sitting were, in the classrooms. I remember sitting in the classrooms, and, you know, you're a senior, nobody cares anymore. talking about what you're going to go see and what you saw and that sort of thing. And I remember that being kind of fun and exciting. And I look at all these movies and I remember where I was and who I was with when I saw them, which is wonderful.
Sure.
You know, Last Crusade, I saw it with a group of friends. What's that? Yeah, me too.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Last Crusade, I saw with a group of friends at the same, you know, at the downtown Oshawa Theater. I think it was the Regent. I saw, you know, just, I was with like 20 people. And I really enjoyed that film. I had a lot of fun with that.
Most of these I saw with my then girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember Ghostbusters 2. My oldest brother, Jack, was working in, I think he was working in D.C. maybe, or maybe he was working in Jersey, I forget. But going out to visit him and like getting off the plane, going to get him at the office and heading to a theater there in Virginia, I want to say, going to see Ghostbusters 2. And there were plastic cups, like glow-in-the-dark cups for the theater.
Oh, I never saw Ghostbusters 2, actually.
Well, there were. I remember that too. There was a big thing with like I couldn't believe there was no merchandise tie-in for Last Crusade. Like there was
very little.
There was a clothing range, and there was some T-shirts and some odds and ends and stuff, but there was no like, you know, glassware or toys or anything like that.
I may have disagreed on this, but I didn't like Temple of Doom. So when I saw Last Crusade, I felt like Indiana Jones was back on track.
I did not hate Temple of Doom when it came out.
Yeah.
But I remember even then immediately kind of thinking, well, they're to me Raiders is a thing of it's perfection. To me Raiders is in a world by itself that the rest of them don't sort of enter into. It just is. As a one-off, to me, it's kind of perfect. And everything else is like a distant sort of cousin of Raiders. And I remember when Temple of Doom hit it, I'm even then thinking, boy, this is trying really hard. Like, it's trying too hard to seemingly top everything that happened in the previous movie. I look back on it now, and it's shocking how dark it is.
Yeah,
it's shocking to me how much they got away with and how it's not a fun movie at all. Like
my son equates it to Spielberg going through a divorce, which is like,
well, I think,
is
I think
even
that's
accurate.
I think he's close. I think it was Lucas going through a divorce.
I think
a lot of the darkness in there. He has even said he was going through a horrible, horrible time at that time. Spielberg was married to Amy Irving at the time.
Okay.
But if you look at some of the making of footage, he's very chummy with Kate Capshaw, and you do kind of think to yourself, that's pretty flirty there, Steve, you know. And then you know things went south with Irving, and you know Kate Capshaw hung in there, and you know the rest is history. But you know Ghostbusters 2. I mean, I remember you know seeing it and really liking the first part, but not really liking the second. But I was excited that it was back because I love all those guys. Last Crusade, I felt the same way you did. I felt like, and that's, it's funny because a criticism of it at the time was that people were saying, well, it's right back to Raiders. It's an artifact, you know, it's something to do with, you know, Christ or God or whatever. It's the Nazis. They're just kind of redoing Raiders, which isn't entirely true, but the same way I defend The Force Awakens in that they're trying to get the memory of the previous stuff out of your head, kind of. Yeah. They want you to get back to familiarity, and that's what Force Awakens did very well. It said, this is not the prequel. This is, again, not. I'm not bashing the prequels. They are what they are. I don't hate them or hate people that dig them, but they're very, very different than the original films, and I think what Force Awakens was trying to do was say, we're going to get back to familiar sort of, you know, territory, and so they kind of, it was a bit of a retread. There's a bit of that with Last Crusade, but I felt the same way that you did, which was the fun is sort of back. But for me, I defend Cowboys and Aliens just because it's Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford, you know, on screen together, you know, and this is, you know, Harrison Ford and Sean Connery on screen. And it just was like, that's what that movie was all about for me, basically.
Oh,
but I think
I
felt the same as you, like,
Yeah.
It's fun. You know, the fun is back.
I want to give, nod to something. The next week I went to the movies again. I think I went to the movies every Friday almost. And I saw Dead Poets Society, which is something we don't think of as a summer blockbuster. That was massive.
Yeah, that was big.
And it was like serious. It was the beginning of serious Beard Robin Williams, you know?
Yeah. It was.
which became a thing.
And it was, I think it was directed by Peter Weir, who I had liked because he did Gallipoli. He directed Gallipoli, and he directed Witness. I think he did The Year of Living Dangerously with
O'Toole and
Mel Gibson.
My Favorite Year.
great movie. Also great movie, directed by Richard Benjamin. Very funny man.
Oh, yes.
He did Witness, and then he did Mosquito Coast, which is one of the best performances Harrison Ford ever gave. But everybody hated it. Like, it just, they hated it. They hated his character. They hated the movie. And he did Dead Poets Society. And so I was, following director's work and stuff in high school.
Yeah, I was starting to.
I knew who he was, but I don't think I saw that movie in the theater.
Oh, I did. I saw it with a bunch of girls, so... that may have been the mitigating factor.
Oh, well,
factor.
Hey, that would have been...
Yeah.
Had I had girls to go with, then I definitely would have seen it. But we should talk about, before we get... We'll talk more about Batman and the anniversary. And this is also Batman's 80th birthday and the movie. It's the 30th anniversary of the movie, and that was a 50th anniversary when it hit, and that was a big deal.
That was part of all the logos
and stuff. We should take a moment. I know we've mentioned it in the past, but we should take a moment and acknowledge that we also just passed up the 30th anniversary of Star Trek V.
Yes.
The Shatner Project. That's the subtitle?
A movie that I actually, like...
Shatner's Turn.
I've joked about this privately, but, you know, I saw that movie when I was on a real upswing with my girlfriend. And, you know, I remember, like, people were like, what'd you think of it? I was like, that was the greatest movie I ever saw. Which was probably more influenced on what happened before and after the film than the film itself. I was just in a very good mood.
Right.
I was tremendously happy. And I remember in college it came on TV once and I was like, is this the same movie? You know?
Memory will do that to you.
Yeah. Oh, the memory will cheat. And especially the circumstances you were in. I have a fondness for it, and I won't apologize for it. It's, you know, it's clearly half a movie. Like, there's a lot going on there, and yes, Shatner was trying to follow the whimsy that was Star Trek IV. Star Trek IV had a lot of comedy in it, but it's a weird script,
Here's what's weird about it, and you will appreciate this because of your affection for Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Yeah.
What's weird about it now, looking back on it and looking through the making ofs and the books, and, you know, Shatner had an on-set diary book that came out, which is fantastic. If you ever want a nice
how
weekend
will I find
meeting,
a copy
find,
for less than
find Shatner's Making of Star Trek V book. It is incredible. Yes, all of the things that you said. I think it's really unfair. Again, I want to stress just how exciting it was and how excited I was to suddenly in one summer have all these things that I loved so much. And I wasn't a huge Lethal Weapon fan, but I liked Lethal Weapon. So even the fact it was another, that was the other big movie, Lethal Weapon movie. Like, it was suddenly action and comic books and Indiana Jones and Star Trek and Ghostbusters
and Bond.
And, you know, all this stuff. And Bond, all in one summer, 30 years ago. It was like, holy shit. Yeah. So, like you, I had a lot of excitement going into Star Trek V.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, it had been, I didn't hate the first one. Loved and obsessed with the second one. Really liked the third one. And, you know, loved the fourth one. I don't know why people badmouth the third one either. There's great stuff in the Lethal Weapon series.
I'm not that big.
Star Trek.
Oh, Star
saying,
Trek.
Didn't. Yeah. Like the motion, but didn't dislike the motion picture. Love Star Trek II. Really like the third one. I don't know why people bag on it. And the fourth one was great. So, you know, you're going into Star Trek V going, what's the worst that can happen? I mean, come on. Like, it's all, you know, it's this cast you're familiar with and so on. What's the most morbidly fascinating to me about it is when you read about or hear about the making of leading up to the motion picture, and people forget, it wasn't like people woke up, you know, in the end of 1978 and said, let's make a Star Trek movie. I mean, it went on for years, the development. Is it going to be a TV thing? And is it going to be a movie? Everybody knows the story. One of the scripts that Roddenberry, I think the first one that he sort of put out there and said, this is going to be the movie or the new pilot or whatever it was that one about God, the God dilemma, problem.
He always wanted to push that one,
And it's freaking, it's mental. If you know anything about this script, it is batshit bonkers. And it might be the one, there's one of them, one of the versions of one of these things has Shatner having a fist fight on the bridge with Jesus. Or I'm not shitting you. Or an
I kind of wanted to see William Shatner fight Jesus now.
You know what? I still think, even though it's Jesus, I still think Shatner could take him. Even now, I think Shatner could take him.
You know, but I'm saying, jury's out on that one for me.
I don't know if it's like an entity is putting on Jesus'
persona,
whatever it is. But there's a fist fight on the bridge. Or one of them, like Shatner goes back in time and doesn't like JFK. It's like someone's trying to stop the assassination, but Shatner thinks JFK is a big head and a braggart and stuff. Some just weird shit. But the God thing was the one that was most prominent. And every time somebody got down the road with it, they'd say, but this is just too crazy.
Yeah.
Or like, you can't go looking, saying God doesn't exist or whatever the hell you wanted to do. Well, what's the thing that they latch onto from Star Trek development from years earlier to make the new one? The God thing.
God, yeah.
Well, I don't know what was so fascinating about that Shatner was like, this is where I want to go with this.
And let's.
Oh, and by the way, I love horses, so we better get some horses.
Oh, yeah, some horses. And let's have Uhura embarrass herself a lot. And let's talk about the incredible merchandise. Like, Galoob had the Star Trek The Next Generation license, and they also had Star Trek V. So they just showered us with stuff. Action figures that were like, they were like McFarlane before McFarlane existed. They were, little dioramas.
But they were soft. That was what was weird about it.
Yeah, they were really, really weird. Yeah.
Like a very strange, it wasn't very, very, the sculpting was very soft, and they came in these big boxes.
Yeah, so here's what's weird. And they were expensive.
So at this point, and they were expensive, and they had them at like Suncoast and stuff. But by the time Star Trek V hit, something else is going on where you've got Star Trek The Next Generation, which people forget, again, was not a huge hit out of the gate.
It was actually, I did a Star Trek convention that year, and people were bitching about the show. They were saying, I don't like it. There was nobody dressed as anybody there. It was really interesting. It was not popular.
No, and it was, but by the time I think Star Trek V hit, it was building an audience.
Slowly.
Like it had kind of turned.
Yeah.
And it was slowly kind of building. And so you've got this, we've got two different properties going on. How did this fit into that world and so on? And then Galoob had the license for
both.
Next Generation did that line of, the shuttle and the diecast ship that everybody could get everywhere for $4. The action figures with the molded on guns and things like that. And then Galoob somehow, well, we've still got the license for Star Trek. Let's make something for this Star Trek V. And I feel like they didn't know what to do. As we discussed this once on one of the episodes about Star Trek, about the Ertl figures and the the Mego, the Ertl, whatever. It just never felt like anybody really knew what to do. Other than the original Megos, people didn't know what to do.
Well, I think
with this property.
The thing with Star Trek is what the Mego era is when kids played with it, and that's about it. Everything else seemed to just sell to adult collectors after that. I don't think a kid has played Star Trek in a large, like, en masse since we were kids. I don't think it's translated. The Next Generation was definitely targeted as adults. The action figures were popular with adult collectors. It's just an adult thing now, whereas
And so I think that's what it was, because you had you had the adult thing kind of starting to poke through, and Galoob must have thought, well, no one's going to want action figures per se, so let's make these things, whatever the hell those things were supposed to be. They were supposed to be adult collector things,
but adult collectors went, what? You know? Oh, yeah, let's talk about the greatest tie-in ever.
Well, and also what's weird about them, just back to those things again, what's weird about them, too, is like, I think one of them is a Klingon, and I don't remember how prominent the Klingons are in this thing, but it was like Klingon, we've been Klingon at that point.
Yeah, it's like Kirk in a weird outfit. It's Cybok.
Kirk in a turtleneck.
Yeah, Kirk in a turtleneck.
Officer's sweater. Yeah.
And then well, that's the other thing. And Cybok, you know, you always want to make the character no one's heard of, because, you know, we all bought so much Lieutenant Ilia stuff. And then, they make the Klingon guy, which is probably a safe bet. And then Spock. Cybok,
the Leo Biscaglia of the Star Trek universe. Cybok. But he...
he's a hugger.
What's great about them is they all were in, like, none of them had uniform. It was all like, they're all like in sort of casual wear, sweaters.
None of them are in any sort of classic Star Trek, you know, regalia. Spock's in a jumpsuit, and it's just that I remember, like, I had a friend who ran a Star Trek store at that time. And you know, he was the guy who had all the Migos from the Migo find, you know, the warehouse find in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And he would run TV commercials. And, you know, they were really nice to me at the time, and they would, you know, have me over to their house, and I could look through the Mego catalogs and, you know, annoy them. And we were going through that ad, you know, of those figures, and he was like, what the hell are these? And, you know, he was just kind of laughing at them. And at that same time, he was the guy that introduced me to what you're trying to lead up to, which is the incredible mail-away promotion of 1989, Kraft Marshmallow Dispenser. And he had them.
One of the greatest and most insane tie-ins. I just picture either the studio, whoever, sitting in a room going, "We got to do like a mail away. We're crap. You know what? They got a prominent scene in the film with marshmallows.
Yes.
Oh shit! Get on the phone with Kraft. We got to do a tie. We got to do packaging and a tie-in. And Kraft made a mail away plastic
because Spock marshmallow wears it in
dispenser.
The film.
Because Spock uses it in the film, and because, you know, what everybody's been missing in their lives is an easier way to hand marshmallows off to people than, you know, just having them reach into a bag.
What ticks me off is Dr. McCoy made beans in that film, and there was no tie-in with Libby's.
There was no tie-in with beans. There should have been. I mean, that's the other thing, too. Like, all of a sudden, you had fart jokes. He had, Kirk tells a fart joke they clearly were hyper aware that the Star Trek IV was massive all over the world. It was huge in parts of the world that had never had didn't know what Star Trek was. In China or somewhere, I think it was China, they had never had a Star Trek film. So they edited together previously on Star Trek movies. They had done like a prologue before the opening credits of Star Trek V to tell you how they got to, or Star Trek IV to tell you how they got to where they are. And then it ends up being this huge thing. And I think it was called The Voyage Home.
Yeah.
And then Star Trek in parentheses or something. So clearly, you know, Paramount and whoever, Shatner, whatever, were thinking, we gotta get some comedy in here. But there's good stuff in that movie.
Yes.
I have to keep saying it, but there is good stuff in that movie. I keep saying this, the scene with Bones and his father.
Yes.
The memory of Bones, that may be the single best thing that DeForest Kelly ever did. He is fantastic in that.
Wait, I saw Nimoy's him great in 2-2-2 with him in it. He was devastatingly good.
Well, what was the one about the Night of the Leapers? The rabbit, he was good in that one, too.
But in room 222, he had a big cookie duster. It was incredible.
he was very good in that one. But and then Kirk, you know, the two bits I remember is him saying, you know, we want to look through your pain, too. And he's like, no, I need my pain.
Yeah.
None of your business, and I need it.
Not a complete train wreck. It's actually got some noble background, and then some terrible special effects. But
terrible.
Yeah.
I remember the shuttle. I remember the shuttle coming into the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And hitting that wall, and even in the theater, going, "Ooh, that looks like balsa wood. Like, who put that? Who did that?"
It was ruined. There was a guy in my grade. I was in OACs at the time. You didn't have, I don't think you had those, but it was this like preparation for university that we had. And guy in my OAC history is like, watch the scene where, you know, Kirk falls off the mountain and Spock's picking him up. The science of it doesn't work. He would have pile-drived Kirk into the ground. And you know, then it was like, you know, stupid me. I watched the movie, and I'm like, ah, shit, he's right, you know. And then it bothered me after
that. And the rock, like, even the wall that Shatner's on.
Yeah.
It looks like a community theater put together, a polystyrene wall and put him on it. They clearly ran out of money, or, you know, Shatner was, you know, he was over his head or whatever it was, but it's not, you know, I'd still watch it before the, you know, Insurrection or any of those.
You know, to be honest with you, any Star Trek movie with the original cast is like pizza. Sometimes it's not the best pizza, but it's still pizza, you know, like you'll still eat the damn thing.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I'd agree with that. And I think we were aware that we were seeing something that, we knew that these weren't going to go on forever.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
You know, Star Trek V ended, and you went, yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I mean, well, we're both there. They were pushing 60 at that time, which seemed like a million years for me at the time. But.
Well, here's the thing. I hadn't gone to when I was young. You know, when I was a kid, I'd gone to some of the Doctor Who conventions that finally hit the Twin Cities. Hadn't been to a sci-fi type convention in a long time. And there was one in town, and it was the Saturday after Star Trek V hit.
Yeah.
And it was Shatner and Nimoy on stage together.
No shit. Wow.
And a friend of mine and I went to the movie the night before, and then we went to the convention the next day, and they ran a bunch of clips with the two of them, and then the last shot was the Harlan Ellison one that he hated, where they jumped through that round thing.
Yeah.
And when that clip ended, they came on stage and they walked through that round thing on stage, and they walked through it with smoke and everything. And then they sort of did some banter back and forth and tried to ignore questions and stuff. So that's what I think of when I think of Star Trek V.
Yeah. I have fond memories of the film, and I think it was pretty great. You know, that was the last film, I think. No, well, there was Ghostbusters 2. I didn't see that. But then there was the last film before, and then I saw Batman. And, you know, I'm just looking through the list. Like, I didn't see Honey, I Shrunk the Kids in the theater, but it's a quality film. I didn't see Do the Right Thing in the theater, but I rented it, and I enjoyed it.
That was that summer,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
I saw that in the theater.
Yeah.
I had seen She's Gotta Have It at the Uptown Theater in Minneapolis when I was 16.
Yeah.
And I knew his stuff. And
yeah,
then
I knew
saw
him
School
too.
Days and then Do the Right Thing. And it was, I remember that movie just knocking me out.
I rented it thinking it was a comedy. I remember thinking, yeah, this is going to be fun. And then, you know, my friends and I sat in silence after that movie. But I really, it challenged me. And
I don't think he's ever topped it. I think he's done great stuff since, but that movie is just...
That's a really good movie.
Holy shit.
I enjoyed the hell out of it. And, you know, at the time I was, you know, I was kind of getting into hip hop, which was weird for a suburban, you know, like, you know, a suburban kid. But it kind of all worked for me. And I enjoyed that film, but I didn't see it in the theater. I didn't see Great Balls of Fire in the theater because I hated it, as I've already mentioned. Karate Kid Part 3, I passed on that one, too. I didn't even know that came out that summer.
I remember that came out. I did not see that. I don't think I saw the second one, even.
So then The Weekend at Bernie's came out. I can't believe that classic came out that summer. I think I rented that sucker, too. Lethal Weapon 2, I did not see in the theater. I don't know about you, if you were a fan of the franchise. But
I saw that in the theater. I wasn't like a huge fan, but I, at that point, Mel Gibson was kind of like, you know, I thought he was, you know, I loved the road. I mean, I was still hanging on to the Road Warrior and Year of Living Dangerously and, you know, the serious stuff that he did,
mm-hmm.
and liked him well enough because of the Australian stuff that he did. But then, you know, I think I kind of get, I don't think I ever saw another one in the theater after that.
Yeah. Basically. And then,
except for Bird on a Wire. Saw that 6 times.
They're during this time.
I'm kidding.
I remember the Bird on the Wire trailer got a lot of laughs, but I've never seen the film.
Oh.
During that time.
But yet, no merchandise.
Yeah, no action figures. During that time in July, a movie came out in Toronto, and I had to take, my girlfriend did not want to go with me. No one wanted to go with me. And I had to take a subway and a bus to see Return of Swamp Thing. In the theater, I had read the novelization, and the Peter David wrote the novelization, who later on write Hulk and.
Kidding!
And it was really good. Like it was a fantastic novelization, and I was like, I got to see this movie. So I get to the mall where it's playing in a, you know, one of those mall plexes. And, like, it's taken me an hour and a half to get there. And I walk into the theater, and I look at the poster, and the poster looks a little jokey. I get in the theater, and there's about 3 other people in the theater. And, you know, the thing comes on, and, you know, it was like, I love it now very much, but... You know when Joe Pesci walks into that room in Goodfellas and realizes he's not going to get made? And he goes, oh, no. And he gets popped. That's sort of what I did. But because it was directed by Jim Warnarski, who actually I'm friends with on Facebook. And, I, you know, like I left. I think it was the first time I walked through a movie and went, okay, this isn't going to be the novel. So just enjoy the ride. And it was a fun movie. Like, I was laughing during it, and I enjoyed it. And I, you know, I never take pop culture too terribly seriously. So, you know, I left that theater and went, I have to buy some Creedence Clearwater records. And that was the only takeaway I got from the movie.
You know, it's funny because when I think of a movie like that, you know, I mean, yeah, people, again, not to sound ancient, but like, you know, We were the generation of the multiplex.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when at the Maplewood Mall in St. Paul, they had one movie theater where I saw a ton of stuff. And it was the kind of theater that when you walked in the door, when you got to the lobby, here's the popcorn and whatever, up on the wall above, like you had to, they put a cordon up before you could go into the movie. You had to wait. So the other one was out, and then, you know, there was no reserved seating. You ran in to get whatever seats you could. And while you were waiting, when you looked up, there were all these black and white shots of famous scenes from, you know, famous shots from movies. So it was like a typical, like, 70s thing. You know, you see them in a lot of 70s photos or, you know, I remember there was a great making of when the Beatles are, like, helping edit Magical Mystery Tour in the Soho edit bay. Up on the wall are all these images of, you know, Edward G. Robinson and Humphrey Bogart, and these black and white. And it was like that very hip thing to do, like in the 70s. There were a lot of black and white shots. Of,
yeah.
And it was, you know, Redford Newman and Raquel Welch from 10,000 years BC or whatever. And, you know, that famous shot of King Kong, you know, holding, you know, walking over the city. And all those,
oh, yeah.
That's what I think of when I think of Maplewood. And it was, I think they had 2 theaters in there. And then they opened a second one, which they called Maplewood 2, which was on the other side of the mall. And it was a theater. And then suddenly they opened 5 more, and it became Maplewood 1 had 6, and Maplewood 2, just on the other side of the mall, had 6. And I might be wrong about this, but I seem to recall they considered that, you know, 12 theaters. And that was the biggest multiplex in the country at that point, I think.
Wow.
Like the biggest number of theaters in one spot. Maybe it was 5 and 5, I forget. But so what I'm saying is, like, when these movies would hit, not only would it come out and you had to see it that summer, and it wouldn't be out, because I think I mean, Ned Hastings, we were just talking about this, and he loves the show, and he's a big Batman fan. So we were talking about, or somebody posted it too, I think an article on the Podstallion thing or the Podcast thing about Batman being the first sort of new movie sell-through title
that was
not a hugely expensive video cassette.
Because after I lost my job at the pizza place, I ended up working at a variety store around October, I'd say, or November, just as Batman hit. And I bought a copy at work, which, you know, I think I was making $5 an hour. And so.
And this is what I remember too about that is. It was also that first time where the videotapes were kind of everywhere.
Yes.
Like if a hardware store wanted to buy copies of Batman to sell them because it was so big, it would be on an end cap at a hardware store. Like the video cassettes were kind of everywhere. This sell-through stuff. So you had to see the movie in the theater, but when I think of something like Return of the Swamp Thing, and I picture looking at the newspaper for the movie listing and these big full page ad for Indiana Jones and a half page for Ghostbusters and da-da-da-da. There was always that one movie that I kind of wanted to see that was at one theater, not one of the multiplexes, just one theater, the Grand View on Grand Avenue for a limited engagement. And it was, you know, Shape of Things to Come or Metal Storm or whatever.
Mark Hamill did one like in the late 80s and it was always one theater
Starscream?
Playing.
Starscream?
It was like Time Runner. And it, you know, like you'd look in the paper every day and it's like it'd be playing at one theater. Mark Hamill and Time Runner, and he had this terrible mustache. And yeah, you'd just go like, oh man, but it would take like, you know, a GO train and then the subway and then a trolley. It would, you know, there's no way I'm going to see
it. So I remember the little, a tiny little ad, you know, as big as a stamp. But it wasn't just the name. It was like a little, it might be a little image, like one little image of a logo or something.
Yeah,
and
that was
Return of the Swamp Thing was one of those movies.
Oh, yeah.
That was at one of those theaters.
Yeah.
And if you didn't see it, if you didn't see it that week or two, that was it.
Summer had me doing a lot of that. I saw the Ramones for the first time that summer, and that was like a two-hour bus ride. So that was like a summer of adventure because after the pizza place closed down, I worked as a, like in drywalling, which was just the most removing wallpaper and then fixing the drywall, which was just a hell job. And so this is all I had to look forward to. Also, my parents moved out. They moved to a new house. And since the house was for sale and it was close to high school and stuff, I got to live there for a long period of time. And actually, it was probably like 6-7 months because they couldn't sell it. I mean, that, you know, eventually I was like, you know, there was no TV and no couch, but I didn't mind. And so it was kind of like this really fun. Yeah, it was a total bachelor pad. And I made good use of it. Because you could have parties. Because it's like, I don't have anything to wreck, you know. So it was a really good time. And I remember going, like, I look at this and go, how come I wasn't at the movies every weekend? But it was the home video market was so good at the time that I was renting stuff.
Yeah.
Now, the next big one I can think of other than License to Kill is, and maybe you weren't into this, but like in July, UHF came out. Were you a fan of that?
Oh, you know what? I remember the trailer.
Yeah.
And I did not see it in the theater, but I remember seeing it when it hit like HBO a year or two later or something, and remember watching it and going, this is actually pretty good. Like,
yeah.
This is not what I thought it was going to be.
One of those movies. There was a theater in my hometown. There was the town over, there was the Marks Theater, and the Marks Theater was always kind of the grindhouse of the town. You know, they always, like, you know, that's where you saw Revenge of the Nerds 2 or Fletch Lives or Caddyshack 2. All films I saw at the Marks, they played UHF.
Caddyshack 2.
Yeah.
Caddyshack 2. Was Caddyshack 2 89? Was that summer of 89?
It was 88. Summer of 88. Yeah.
Just one of those. How did this happen? That's like that Crocodile Dundee where he shows up like 20 years later. There's another, like, there was a Crocodile Dundee in Hollywood. There was a one in like 86. There was a two in 88. and then they did a 3 in like in Hollywood, which was like 15 years later.
Yeah, I was like, wondering, like, maybe they thought that we were all pining for that. I'm not sure anyone was, but I when that came out, I remember thinking, like, somebody misjudged our nostalgia for Crocodile Dundee movie.
Yeah, well, it was in development for so long, and they wanted to get it right. So it just...
Yeah, complete script
really
supervision.
And they really had to take their time.
That guy, that actor, I don't know his name, so we'll just call him Crocodile Dundee. Have you ever looked up how old he is now?
Paul Hogan?
Thank you, Crocodile Dundee.
I remember in 86, he was like in his mid-50s, I thought, early 50s.
Yeah, he's like, I got one of those, you know, days where I didn't want to work.
Got lost on the internet.
Yeah, he's like 80 now.
Yeah, and didn't he have like a sketch show in Australia for years?
He was a big hit in Australia, and
you know what's funny? The nostalgia, the stuff that I'm thinking of when I think about this stuff, and this is where the walking the line sort of comes in about nostalgia for the stuff that we love and what it was when we grew up and the things that were events and so on and so forth. Now I'm thinking about, let's say it's 1989, and it's Friday. You know, I've been going to school, you know, college, I'm going to school that week, and it's Friday, I'm going to go see this movie. And you go out, maybe you go for pizza afterwards or something, and hang out with your special lady or whatever. And then I start thinking, like, what did I do the rest of that weekend? Yeah. Because, truthfully, there was no internet. There were three stations. I mean, you had cable, I suppose, but, I mean, if you didn't, you didn't have much to sort of, you know, like... Like I don't have, you know, kids or a big family, whatever. So I can't understand what people go through when they don't have time. So I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that there is kind of, we're lucky enough to be in the age too, that the things that we loved are kind of at our fingertips now.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you want to watch Space 1999, you can just go watch it, or UFO or whatever. There's just a wealth of stuff that we can pick up and look at or listen to or read or see. I'm not saying we were miserable and we weren't happy at the time or anything, but it's interesting thinking about that summer because you go Lethal Weapon, you know, as movies, I'm saying as big event things, Lethal Weapon, Batman, License to Kill, Ghostbusters 2, maybe Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Star Trek 5, you know, whatever. There's like maybe 5 or 6 big movies. And then once you get past that, they get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
And, you know, but now it's like, it's every week there's another massive thing that's hitting.
Yeah.
Which is great. There's much more to choose from.
I do miss the small movies like the UHF. And, you know, I remember Jason Takes Manhattan was a big deal to us. Even though it really wasn't a very good film, it looked great. You know, there was just these little films that showed up, and you know, it's funny. We've joked about this at the start, but when you got that Warner Brothers brochure for the Batman, they promoted other Warner Brothers releases in it, like Lethal Weapon 2. There was Lethal Weapon 2 merchandise, if I recall. There was like, you know, the Boom.
Yep. There
toilet.
Was Beetlejuice. They had Beetlejuice pins and a T-shirt, I think.
They had all this promotion for Young Einstein. They thought that Young Einstein was going to be the big hit of the summer because it was a hit in Australia. And I think it debuted in August. And it just went absolutely nowhere. No one cared. And, you know, it was funny because it was, you know, they really thought Yahoo Serious was going to be the next Paul Hogan, to put that.
Yeah.
And nobody cared. And I think I saw another Yahoo Serious movie where he played Ned Kelly that came up on cable in the 90s. And I remember going, oh, yeah, that guy. You know, that guy was supposed to be huge.
I saw another one too. And maybe it was Ned Kelly. Maybe it was some other genius or something. But he, and then of course I eventually saw Young Einstein
years later on
cable or something. I sat through like 30 minutes and it's just god awful.
Yeah, it's.
But yeah,
he thought
it was going to be huge.
He had a very absurd sense of humor, and it just didn't resonate. I find that really funny. Like, the stuff that didn't, that they thought was going to be a lock that wasn't, you know? And one of the things I wanted to talk about before we wrap up is, do you remember the magazine I think Topps put out for Batman that summer?
Yeah, I remember. I remember there was a magazine that Topps put out.
Yeah,
there was a hardcover book that was just called the Batman book or Batman the movie book. It was hardcover that I picked up, and there was the comic adaptation that all hit around the same time.
Oh yeah, I had that too. So that Topps
and I got the trading cards too. I would buy the trading cards and the Ghostbusters 2 trading cards, and for the first time since I was a kid, I was trying to collect the entire set of cards.
I remember, for some reason. I think it was one morning in the summer when my parents said that we were moving, I was in a bad mood, and I thought, you know, I'm really not reading these comic books, and I had complete runs of, you know, like McFarlane's run on Spider-Man and that sort of thing, and I walked it down to the local comic book store, and the guy just, you know, he couldn't keep that stuff in stock, and he bought it all. And I remember thinking, oh, I made some money. And then I saw the box of Batman trading cards and, like, pissed away half the money on those, which was just, you know, I remember sitting there doing, like, you know, going through them going, what did I just do?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
And there was, do you remember there was, what they did was they, maybe I'm wrong about this. They put out individual packs. Then they put out the box that had the gold foil sealed sticker on it that had, like, 10 extra cards that you couldn't get in the individual pack.
Oh, I don't remember that.
Or something.
Yeah.
But then they also, they put out the 66 Batman cards, a reprint set of those. You remember that?
Oh, no, I don't remember that. No, I don't think that hit my area.
I think they did. And they were just kind of, you know, one of those things I remember seeing in the toy shop paper all the time were those cards, like, you know, you could get sets of those reasonably priced inside. But you could get the sets, or you buy a box of individual packs, or you get a box of the complete set. But it was like $20 at the time, I think. I want to say it was that much money. It was not cheap.
One of the things I remember was that Topps magazine had an interview with collector Joe Desrus, who was the king of Batman at that time. And, you know, I was still heavily into Mego collecting, and he had just, they had done a splash page of his collection. You know, he had Kresge carded Joker, and I just honestly remember burning holes in those photos because, you know, these are the pre-internet days. Mm. And to see beautifully printed color photos of this guy's Mego Batman collection was insane. And, you know, and I can honestly remember sitting there like 18 years old going, I'm going to be this guy. You know, I'm going to get all this stuff.
Wow.
I remember that very vividly. Like you're saying, what did we do with our time? I did stuff like that, you know. And it was, you know, because there was so little instant gratification, you know, and I was so excited to see that stuff in publication. Stuff like that,
It was a different time, too, where, and this is what made collecting somewhat, again, it's 6 to 1, half dozen to the other, where, like, now you're looking for something, you can put the word out, and within a week somebody might have it. Whether you can afford it or whether you should buy it or not, it's different. But back then, there really was that you know, you won't. It was unobtainable.
Yeah.
Like, it's something that if you saw it in a magazine like that, where would I start? How can I start to try to track this thing down or whatever it was?
Yeah.
You know, well, and for me, it was that.
What's that? For you, it was.
Well, I was gonna say for me, it was that summer that things started to change with Bond when License to Kill was about to come out. I had just rediscovered there were two Bond fan clubs. One was an American one. One was a UK one, which I think is still going. The UK one's still going. They would put out this glossy, very expensive club to be in, but they put out a glossy color, mostly color magazine for Bond and stuff. But there was also this, again, pre-internet, there was this magazine called the James Bond Collectors Club. And I have all of my issues still. And it was when it would show up from England, and it was only published like twice a year, I think. And you open this thing up, there were things in there that were like, it took me years to even see a photo on the internet of. Like one issue I remember somebody was like, wow, look what someone just discovered. Did you know that for The Spy Who Loved Me, Edai Grip in Japan made a Lotus Esprit where the wheels fold in and the thing comes out. And there were photos of it in this thing that were like, you know, it was like the Shroud of Turin. You know, you'd look at this like,
oh yeah, my God,
and
there wouldn't be enough.
Ever find
there wouldn't
thing?
Be enough information for you. It'd just be a photo and a passing. You'd be like, no, I need more. You know, I can honestly
and
remember
and like
that.
You say that when you say burn holes in the burning holes in the diary, just looking at them over like that. It's a Small World catalog. We keep talking about it, but I found that, by the way. I found it. I know where I put it. I found it, but. That was another one where you just – I could not look at that thing enough.
That was
like
porn.
Toy porn.
Yeah, toy porn.
Oh, it was absolute toy porn. And then, you know, there was one of the Bond magazines that had a James Bond attaché made by Tomy in Japan. And it had this beautiful shot of Connery inside of it, you know, from like – I mean, like an early publicity shot of Connery from like from Russia with Love. So this thing must have been made in like the late 60s. I eventually found one. Not that I was looking every day or every month, but I eventually found one a couple of years ago that was missing a couple of pieces, but it's still a very, very rare thing. But I'm saying it, the first time I ever saw it was like summer of 89 in one of those magazines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
I would like to very happily announce that I have everything Mego that Joe Desrus had in that photo now.
Take that, Desrus.
Took me 30 years, Joe Desrus. What was funny was... I think it was about 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago. I was at Kane County Toy Show, and I was at my friend Mark Huckabone's booth. I think I was actually watching Mark Huckabone's booth because, you know, that's how he'd be. And a guy came up, talked to him, gave him a magazine, and walked away. And Mark goes, look what Joe Desrus just gave me. And I was like, oh, crap, I would have actually liked to have said hi to him. You know, he doesn't know who I am, but, you know, I wanted to thank him for that photo. I did not do that, but thanks, Joe. That was awesome.
Do you remember? This may blow your mind. Maybe we've talked about this before, but do you remember? You know, we're big fans. We are of Starlog magazine,
Which was still. Do you remember? Still going strong in 1989. It was still important.
Oh yeah, and they. Yeah. Do you remember those toy books that they put out, or like those
what's his name did, what's his name, Skywalker, Obi-Wan Ranch guy,
Obi-Wan
sorry I'm butchering this. I just can't Steve remember Sansi. His name Steve Sansweet. Thank you. Yes,
just Club Obi-Wan is fine. People will know who you're talking
guy
about.
With a beard.
The guy with the beard, he's got everything.
Yeah, he's got all the dolls.
And wants more. He wrote that. I found many years later, I discovered.
You know, one of the other things I could honestly remember that summer, and it's, you know, I don't want to sound like we're just two old guys. But
no. I hope you're going to say Ecto Wine Cooler, the Ecto Cooler that Heisey
no, we
put
didn't
out.
Get that.
That was delicious. You didn't get Ecto Cooler?
No. I didn't go for the joke. Ghostbusters that summer. That summer... I ordered blindly at a Toy Shop magazine, and the night of my prom, so while I'm putting on my tux, I get a box, and it's got...
I can't tell you how romantic I think you are now with the honeymoon, night of the prom. What did you order?
I ordered the Daypole Doctor Who figures. Now, I had not been a fan of Doctor Who for years because I did not really care for the Colin Baker era. But I got kind of roped back into the I got kind of roped back into the McCoy years. I kind of liked McCoy, but when I saw action figures for sale, I bought every single one. And I can honestly remember I was putting on my tux. I opened the box. I put them all across my bed, and I just went, man, this is a really cool time. You know, Doctor Who action figures. You know, I even bought a Bonnie Langford action figure, you know.
You turned around, and there was your date. You went, Tina, what are you doing here?
She was actually a Doctor Who fan.
I'm kidding.
I actually brought her to a Star Trek convention that summer, and she stayed with me.
Oh, bless her heart.
Because she just wanted to see it, you know. And you got Kirk and Spock. I got Mark Leonard. And... I brought Mark Leonard two things. I brought him a carded Romulan and a carded Urko, and he hated it. He was – sorry, you go ahead.
No, but I remember that story about him being a D-bag. Yeah.
He was mad about royalties, but yeah.
Yeah, he – it's funny because I know. I went to the Star Trek Summit a few weeks back, which is like,
oh, wow.
CBS. You know,
did you get CBS to the port licenses? Done?
Yes, I did. I helped generate peace between the Kardashians and
gentlemen. We have a lot of Star Trekking to Kardashians. Do tonight.
Yeah, between the Jawas and the that's Star Wars. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, the Hobbits.
The Hobbits and the Jawas.
Yeah.
They you know, they had some talent there and stuff, and Jonathan Frakes was there and this and that, and then they
like
were talking
you said
about
they
this.
Had some talent and Jonathan Frakes.
No, I meant because Frakes is more like sorry, Frakes is, you know, he's a big time director now, and he's directing the new show with Picard, with Patrick Stewart and everything, and they were talking about that, and I thought, you know, I don't know enough of Next Generation. I should. It's on Netflix now, so. So I asked a couple of friends that are big Next Generation fans. I was like, give me some titles of some of the episodes. And it's funny looking through some of them, because I do remember watching it. There's quite a few that are kind of ringing bells to me that I remember seeing, like the one with the Borg, you know, the two-parter. That was a big deal. Like that was,
that was
you know, because it was a syndicated show. People forget too, that it wasn't, it was perhaps to have that be like an event was kind of a big deal for that, that cliffhanger stuff. So I'm going through things and I have to be honest, and I know we've done stuff for sort of, and I'm not being critical. A lot of them are just like, or just kind of, you know, I don't think a lot of them, I don't think have anything on 80s Doctor Who. Like they're literally like the scripts, maybe the budget a little bit more. And then there are some that are really good. And there's that one with Mark Leonard. I think it's just called Sarek or whatever. And he is fantastic. And so Stewart. And I don't know if I ever saw it when it aired.
I remember that one. Yeah. He's getting old, right?
He's getting old and he's got basically like dementia and you know, spoilers, but he's not all there. And then Picard's like, look, why don't we do the mind meld? Give me your shit, and then you can go into this thing and get peace between whoever and whomever, and you'll all be together. And then, Picard's got all his baggage, and there's a scene with Stewart that is just sublime, where he's basically Sarek and getting out the emotion that he's had to keep suppressed his entire life. Really, really good. I don't know if I ever saw that one.
Yeah, I remember liking that one.
And then there's another one that's a two-parter with Spock that was a precursor to Star Trek VI.
Yeah, I remember that one.
That was a big event.
I lived in a dorm around the early 90s, so that was always on TV. It was always in the background. So, you know, like, even though I wasn't a huge fan of it, I saw them all, man.
Well, can you explain, speaking of Frakes, why does he walk like his shoulders are off kilter? He would walk and it was like his shoulders were like at an angle.
I don't know, but he's got an expression on his face like he just had a massage.
He does.
A really good meal.
You know, there's no way you watch that show, especially the early ones, and you just know that Roddenberry's fingerprints are all over it.
Oh yeah.
Especially the uniforms, and you go, he got his way again. They let him do motion picture, and they said, you need to step back so we can do some serious uniforms here. But by God, Next Generation, he's like, put him in the onesies again with the feet.
And I don't want to, but he had some ideas about no conflict, and that's probably why I don't love the Next Generation, is that, you know, one of the most interesting things about Star Trek is the fact that, you know, you had McCoy yelling at Spock every episode, and it just didn't seem like Star Trek to me.
I totally agree. There's a great article that I read about that Borg episode, which was, I think, just like a week ago or something, like the 25th or 28th anniversary of those episodes or something. I think Ron Moore, you know, who ended up doing the reboot of Battlestar Galactica, and some other people wrote on it. And the episode after Picard, the two-parter, Picard goes off for some R&R because he's like got, you know, PTSD from the experience, and he's with his brother and there's conflict and stuff. And somebody said to Ron Moore, go off and just write this thing. And apparently Roddenberry got a hold of it and said, no, it's not going to work. It's something about there's too much conflict and there wouldn't, we're past that, you know, there wouldn't be this baggage for them, you know, as brothers or whatever. We'd be past that at this point in the universe or in human. And someone just said, just ignore him. And then they went ahead and made it, and it became this, you know, critically acclaimed.
It's a good episode. You know. Yeah, it's one I actually genuinely like, even though really it nothing is. Really it's happens.
It's the one that they're, yeah, it's just him and the brother, right? And they're arguing, and it's great. Yeah. Patrick Stewart, next to Nimoy, Patrick Stewart, that's the thing, that's what's kept me watching a lot of these. Patrick frickin' Stewart, he is, whatever he's given to say, he is just 1,000%.
Well, you know, what's funny about him is that my friend and I were having a conversation on the drive to Mego Meet, and we started talking about that Saturday Night Live he did, you know, where he's the guy who runs the erotic cake shop. But every cake has people going to the bathroom on it. And that was the first time you realized, holy shit, it's like Leslie Nielsen. The first time you realized, oh, he can be really, really funny.
Yeah.
You know, and, totally. And that was you know, unfortunately, I think it's been run into the ground with him. But he was, you know, that was shocking of how funny he was. And
that's what got me keen about watching some of these was the new show. There's a new you know, CBS All Access type thing. It was called Picard, I think. And I thought, well, I should get some background before I get ready for this and see what he does. But
weird that we're nostalgic for that, eh?
That's anything else? Weird. Summer of '89. Any other movies?
The only one I would wrap up with is The Abyss, which was supposed to be the big sci-fi blockbuster. I remember liking it, not loving it. That was my takeaway. I remember going like, that was okay. You know, because it was like, there was Deep Star 6, and there was another underwater movie, and then The Abyss.
And Leviathan? Was it Leviathan?
Leviathan, yeah. And,
classic,
you know,
Peter
they
Weller.
Were all kind of lumped in the same vein, but they were all completely different. Deep Star 6 was garbage. Leviathan was interesting, you know, kind of failed, and then I think Cameron's work works, but it just isn't my favorite movie. My wife loved this.
I remember seeing it opening night. Again, that's another one that I saw opening night, and because we were so high off of Alien, like what is this guy going to do next?
That's what I thought it was going to be,
and thinking it was really good.
Yeah.
But then when you get to the end, when you get to the, you know, the floaty people and the butterfly people and Ed Harris being down the, I just went, oh, what the, and it's one of those movies that I point to and go, it's like The Mist. You know, we always talk about The Mist and people defend The Mist to death. But I always say it is such a good movie. And then right when you get to a certain point, I can't recommend it because it just, if I'm going to take someone along. And The Abyss was like, if you all of a sudden went, where did the, it reminds me of that, remember that Simpsons, like, I bring you love.
Yeah.
When the alien came, it was Mr. Burns. Weren't they kind of making fun of The Abyss of that? The floaty, I bring you love.
I think the one thing about The Abyss that really blew my mind was that Chris Elliott's in it. You know, like, I was a Letterman guy. I'm sure you were at the time. And
Chris Elliott, He's above water.
Yeah. And my friend Ken, who ran that comic store, I remember he invited me over for libations and to watch the extended Laserdisc of The Abyss, which the libations really helped because it was long. And there's a very long scene of Chris Elliott singing in this, like, you know, Japanese Laserdisc.
Oh, I don't remember that. I remember the director's cut. I don't remember that.
Yeah, and I remember that. I remember thinking, oh, yeah, this is what this movie needed, more Chris Elliott, you know, which I was
Michael
a huge
Bean,
fan.
Michael Bean, that was like the trifecta, where it was like, this guy can do anything. Yeah. Like, that was one you just go, Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss, and now he's playing the kind of a bad guy? This guy, what can't this guy do?
Yeah.
And then we found out, because I don't know if he ever was in a major motion picture after that, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, that is a weird. You're absolutely right. He just kind of disappeared.
He was the shit, you know. And he came into Aliens. I don't know if a lot of people know this. I just sound like Michael Caine there. Not a lot of people know this, but James Remar had the part of Corporal Hicks.
That's right. Alien. Yeah, from Warriors.
And I think they shot for like a week or two. And the only thing I've ever found out about it, because I think Michael Biehn has never said anything negative about Remar, but Remar himself has said, I had a pretty bad drug problem. And he got busted or something, or there was some issue. But they basically called Michael Biehn. They were like, can you do this? We need you to be on a plane, you know, on Monday or something. And it was like he was just dropped into the whole scene, you know, a week or two in it. So I thought this guy was the real deal. Like, he's going to,
yeah,
you know.
Me too.
He's going to be huge. And then I don't know what happened.
That summer also had a movie called Eddie and the Cruisers 2, Eddie Lives. And it had Michael Perry.
You answered all the questions from the...
It bombed. Yeah. It super bombed. But Michael Perry was another guy that I thought was going to go real far in the 1980s.
You know, it's funny you mentioned him, because I watched something a couple weeks ago. There's a guy out there. Did you see the movie Bone Tomahawk?
No.
Okay. I would recommend it because it's a trip. It's a Western, Kurt Russell, Patrick Wilson, a bunch of, you know, faces are in it. It's a Western. It's a posse getting together trying to find this woman who's been kidnapped by these really freaky, you know, this freaky tribe that does freaky stuff. And then about halfway through, it takes a turn that's just holy. You know, it's borderline exploitation, but it's very good. But the guy that did it has since done two other movies, and he's got a really interesting voice. You know, I think he's kind of a conservative. There's something about him that's very right wing that kind of makes me nervous, and we'll get to that some other time. But anyway, yeah. I read that he had done this Puppet Master movie. He wrote this Puppet Master script, which was, you know, $4, you can rent it kind of thing. And I think I saw the first Puppet Master, and I thought, well, if this guy wrote it, maybe Thomas Lennon is in it. How bad could it be? It's horrific. It is one of the worst things. It's brand new. And it's one of those things you just go, I don't know where they got the money for this. I don't know how this happened. The whole thing looks like a rehearsal. It's god awful. But all of a sudden, Michael Paré shows up in it.
Yeah.
And I got to say, he looks amazing.
By the way, he's Michael also in Bone Tomahawk.
Holy shit. Well, there you go. There's the connection with Michael Paré. He looks fantastic. You can't believe that it's been that long since Eddie and the Cruisers. I saw him and I'm like, man, what's he doing? Right.
He's only in his late 50s. Yeah.
He looks good, man. He looks really good. Because he was in Greatest American Hero. He was the tough kid that
he
wanted
to
punch.
Yeah, he was with Faye Grant, who was like Julian V, like the next year, but she was playing a high schooler. We were just watching Greatest American Hero not long ago because it's on Prime. And wow, she's really leather Tuscadero-ing it quite a bit.
Yes, she does. She does the kind of Brooklyn. You're like, aren't you guys in California? Why are you talking like that?
California, why do you all talk like that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you guys are in Sherman Oaks. Why are you talking like you're from Brooklyn?
Yeah.
Isn't she married to Stephen Collins? No, she's not married to Stephen Collins. She is married to Stephen Collins.
I don't think anymore.
I think she's...
I think she was.
Probably not anymore.
Not anymore.
Right, right. But see, it always comes back to Star Trek, the motion picture.
It does. It does. Buy it on Blu-ray.
I think she... You know, we're going to have to do an anniversary episode in December.
HD copy. Actually, I was looking for it. I was at Giant Tiger yesterday, and I was digging through, and I found a whole bunch of Godzilla movies on Blu-ray, and Star Trek IV fell out of the box, and I was like, if the motion picture's here and it's $6, I'm going to buy it. I know I'm going to buy it.
Without going into detail, motion picture is not the one you want to get in HD. That's all I'm going to say.
Mm, nope, it is not.
Stephen Collins, motion picture.
Well, I like to put a post-it note on the screen.
It's a black bar across the bottom of the
screen. It just says no.
Letterbox to letterbox.
All right. Well,
no,
I think.
All right, that's a great way to wrap it up.
And with a crotch joke. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back sooner than later. We're hoping to do a mini next week, and we'll talk to you all again. Thank you again for all the kind words. I ran into some lovely people at Mego Meet who told me what fans they were of the show, and that really made our day.
Yeah,
made my day. And then
how come no one's talking about me? I don't know. I need to
because you are an island, sir.
I am. It's a lonely freaking island, too. It's a very lonely island.
And I did love...
It's called Monster Island.
I got this sent to me, and I'll end the show with this. guy. I appeared on a video on YouTube, which I'm not a front of the camera guy, and I got a text or through Facebook, a guy. I'm pumping gas. This is like 7 a.m, and I get this thing that says, "You know, I always thought you'd look more like Dom DeLuise," and that's I don't know what you had to take that. I just thanks.
Wow.
You know?
Listen, he's beloved. He's a legend. He was Captain Chaos. I mean, there are worse things to have been thought to look like.
I just got to go get one of those hats.
That's a very, very, very funny thing to say to someone.
Oh, I mean, I don't know if he's laughing.
It's hilarious, though. I always thought you'd look more like Dom DeLuise. I don't get it, but it's very funny.
Yeah, but you know what's really funny is I got in the car and I had told my daughter, and she just kind of, and then I had to explain to her who Dom DeLuise was, which, you know, wasn't as fun as I had hoped. You know, I haven't completely made her socially awkward.
The kids today, they don't appreciate Dom DeLuise like they used to.
No, they're all about Peter DeLuise now, you know?
Right, exactly. They've moved on. The next generation, DeLuise, the next generation. All right,
thanks, everybody.
Stuff. Thanks, everybody. Happy
Talk
anniversary.
To you soon. And stop. Magical.
Good.